This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Last week, we talked about allocating your assets so you wouldn't lose purchasing power by keeping too much in cash. We're going to take that topic of allocation a little further this week and talk about, okay, how about having a plan to meet specific income or a specific investment need? So we're going to start fine-tuning this theme over the next couple of weeks.
So that's our topic for the first half of the program. In the second half of the program, Scott Cohn, lead investigative reporter for CNBC and the developer of CNBC's annual America's Top States for Business series, is going to give us the skinny on, what else, the best states for business. And Jim, it should come as no big surprise that our home state, California, did not top that list.
Really? Yeah, that's right. California dropped to 47th place out of the 50 states because it's so expensive. Now, here's a surprising thing. It'd probably be in number 50th place if it wasn't for two things. One, it was first in access to capital. Think of Silicon Valley, think of private equity, think of venture capital firms. So that's what really helped California was access to capital. And second, is no surprise, it was very high on technology and innovation. You think of Apple, you think of all the technology companies, Hewlett-Packard, all of those companies up in Silicon Valley. So if it wasn't for those two things, and if California loses those two things, we're in deep trouble.
Well, I was just reading this report, Jim, and kind of laughing to myself because access to capital and technology and innovation tells me that we're a great place to start a business in, but our expenses and our taxes make us a bad place to keep a business in.
And that's exactly, as you'll hear in this interview, what a lot of companies are doing. Even though you have Apple still located in Cupertino, that's not where they're building their three new factories that they're bringing back to the United States. They're building them outside. A lot of the tech companies, HP, eBay, Oracle, a lot of the companies are relocating to other states. Austin, Texas is now giving Silicon Valley a run for the money and could become the next Silicon Valley in the next decade. So California better watch it. They just raised minimum wages, and they're already talking about raising taxes again next year. They may be driving some of these companies out. This reminds me, Catherine, what we saw in New York City in the 70s, where you had almost 150 of the Fortune 500 companies were located in New York. Today, there's probably less than 30. Most of those companies just left New York because of the very same things that we're seeing in California. High regulatory environment, business unfriendly, high taxation, cost of living, all those things. Eventually, companies leave like Wells Fargo and Bank of America did. And I could see more of that happening over the next decade. So I think those two features, access to capital and technology and innovation, I think that could move out of this state as well.
Well, Jim, let's kind of move on past our state's undesirability as a place to do business. And let's refocus ourselves on the first topic of today's program, which is about allocation. So let's start with knowing what you need. Let's first talk about generating income that you might need for retirement.
Before you start producing income for yourself, the first thing you need to know is how much income do you need? Your income needs are all tied to basically your spending. What are you spending? What's your budget? And to some extent, your desire to leave an inheritance. But for right now, we're going to focus on spending. You know, as financial planners, we like to divide spending into three categories. Let's say the need to have, that's kind of the basics. What does it cost to live? Which includes the necessities of life. Think food, shelter, transportation. Then you get to want to have, which includes extras like, okay, entertainment, cell phones, iPads, dining out, non-essential clothing, travel, And then the wish to have, which includes things like, okay, that second home, the vacation home, a boat, an RV, maybe starting a business, and so on. But each one of these categories of spending needs a source of income that's appropriate for it. So for the must-haves, you need certainty. You need to have things like Social Security, pension, income that comes predictably from a bond or an annuity, because this is what it costs you to live, and you don't want to sit there and speculate and say, well, I wonder if this company will pay a dividend. I wonder if I'm going to get rent from this property or investment. You want certainty in the first category, which is need to have. The second category, which is what we call want to have, that can be filled by things like income from bonds, annuity income, and also dividends. And so this is sort of those extra things that go on top of the cost of living. And then finally, the wish to have things like an RV, a boat, a luxury item. Those assets are saved up and liquidated at a future date. So something that is more growth-oriented in your investment portfolio, like blue chip stocks, are going to be more appropriate for achieving that third goal of, gosh, I'd love to have something like this someday.
Well, as you can tell from listening to what Jim just covered in terms of what's appropriate for each type of spending, there's a certain element of risk in meeting each of those three types of spending needs. So let's talk about risk. Let's just assume that Social Security is going to be around as long as you need it, and that your company will stay solvent long enough to keep paying your pension, and that the insurance company your annuity is with stays solvent and keeps making your annuity payments. I know that's a lot of assumptions, may not all come true, but we're just going to assume those things. Any spending needs past what's covered by Social Security, your pension, or your annuity has to come from some kind of source that involves some form of investment risk. We talked about bonds. Bonds involve interest rate risk, company risk, municipal, city, state risk, country risk. To some extent, if you're doing U.S.-based bonds, dollar risk. And that's just a few of the risks that bonds involve. Stocks, which we talked about for more of the want to have and wish to haves, those involve market risk and company risk and a lot of other risks as well. And we talked about this last week. Even if you had enough cash saved up to meet all your spending needs for the remainder of your life, you would still be taking dollar risk and inflation risk.
And sometimes we get calls from investors. They're looking for what I call a no-risk investment or a no-risk source of income. I hate to be the one to burst your bubble, folks. There is no investment like that. The trick is really trying to match the investment and the risk with the purposes. Remember, we said in your budget, you have three things that you need: your must-have, need-to-have budget, your want-to-have budget, and your wish-to-have budget. And you can tailor a portfolio of investments that meet each one of those objectives. And I want to go back to a case that we talked about, Bill and Jan Smith, again, to discuss their spending and income needs. Now, as you recall from last week, their spending looked pretty much like follows. They needed to have $90,000 was their need-to-have budget. Their want-to-have budget was $10,000. And their wish-to-have budget was $5,000. That was basically annual gifts that they were making to their grandchildren. So the total was $105,000. Now, if you look at their incomes, you had Bill's Social Security of $17,400. You had Jan's pension of $54,000. So that was $71,000. So their shortfall on the need-to-have portion of their budget was the $90,000 versus the $71,000 that they had coming in from Jan's pension and Bill's Social Security. So the shortfall was roughly about $18,500.
Well, when we met with Bill and Jan, our first priority, which it should be your priority as well if you're making a plan for your income need, our very first priority with them was to meet their need to have shortfall, and to meet that need to have shortfall with a dependable source of income. And that's where Jan's annuity came in. You may remember we did a 10-year term certain single life annuity. It produced $24,000 a year, which was a little over their roughly $18,000 to $19,000 need to have shortfall. So we met that shortfall with a dependable source of income. So annuitizing your assets through a reputable, financially sound insurance company can be a really good way to sort of fill up any holes in your essentials budget, because you don't want to risk any interruptions or problems with the sources of income for your need to have budgets.
And, you know, once you go beyond the need to have spending, we still wanted to meet their what I call want to have spending needs. For Bill and Jan, that was basically travel, as it is for many retirees. Since these aren't as critical, let's say, to life, meeting their basic living needs, we could afford to take a little bit more risk to produce this income. That is why we chose bonds, $500,000 out of Bill's portfolio, basically, which was an IRA rollover, which would produce $20,000 of income that would recover the remaining sort of want to have and even part of their wish to have spending. So we were able to go a little bit out, not much, but a little bit further out on the risk curve because bond prices fluctuate. But by using individual bonds, we kept the maturities within a range that every year the maturities get shorter and there was less market risk.
So I think what's really important to notice here is, again, we did bonds for Bill, not only because he needed a fairly dependable source of income, but also because Bill wasn't a huge fan of the stock market. So we wanted to make sure we met those two needs for him with that portion of his portfolio. And I was just remembering, since we met their need to have and their want to have and even their wish to have budgets, we could put the remainder of their assets in something that was just a little bit more risky than that. So that's kind of where the remaining portion of Bill's IRA, which is about $150,000, and the last piece of Jan's 403b rollover, which was about $70,000, that's where we rolled those into dividend-paying stocks because those stocks produce a dividend. Hopefully the dividend increases year over year. If we're doing our job right and if things go well, hopefully the underlying stock appreciates as well over time. So we were able to take a little bit more risk with the remaining portion of their portfolios. But again, I think it's really important to remember that each asset we placed them in had its very important purpose. And the purpose of some of these dividend payers was, one, to keep up with inflation, and two, hopefully by growing these assets, maybe they could fulfill more of their dreams in retirement, number one, or maybe number two, they could actually leave a larger inheritance for their kids. So again, each portion of what we do in your portfolio or what you do in your portfolio when you're planning for income needs to have a specific purpose and it needs to have a specific risk profile that suits that purpose.
And this leads us to our second topic today, which is know what you want. Now, with Bill and Jan, their strategy was driven by their, right at the top, was their income requirements because they were retired. What they wanted from their investments was mostly stability and income with a little growth. But each type of investment they were in, the annuity, the bonds, and the stocks, all had a specific purpose related to their various income needs. Now, the point of matching your investments to their purposes is not only to meet the specific goals, but hopefully to reduce folks' stress levels. As long as you understand the role of each type of investment in your portfolio, I think it's much, much easier to manage the inevitable up and downs that you're going to see if you have an investment portfolio. I mean, if you have an annuity, you have a bank account, you don't have to worry about fluctuation risk. But no investment is going to go up all the time. So your portfolio should be a blend of investments with specific purposes. Each type of asset is going to take a turn in being the superstar, and its turn is being an underdog. So you need to be prepared for this and not get flustered if you see a market correction, just as we've seen over, let's say, the debt ceiling debate and the budget debate that we've seen here in the last couple of weeks with the government shutdown. So you need to educate yourself on acceptable risk parameters for each investment. It really reminds me, I can't help but think back to the end of the summer when we came back after our summer recess that we usually take the last couple of weeks of August. Now think about this, folks. You know, when we came back from Labor Day, what were the things the market was worried about? Number one, at the top of the list was Syria. That went by the wayside. Number two, was it going to be Yellen or Larry Summers? Well, we know today it was Yellen. Three, well, was the Fed going to taper or not taper? Well, we had the September 17th meeting. They did not taper. And then fourth, we're going through it now, which is the debt ceiling. Now, investors got nervous, and I was amazed at some people predicting crash. Some people are saying, get all your money out of the market. Yet we had, despite all those four worries, the best September in the stock market. The stock market was up over 4%, and it was one of the best Septembers in market history. And it's only happened 7 times in the last 100 years. Now, think of all those four worries, and it was the best September. Even now, on the day that we're doing this recording, the markets are looking pretty good. They're rallying. that we're going to get some kind of resolution to the debt ceiling crisis. And what I'm getting at is this. It's easy to get spooked by the rhetoric and the hyperbole. And remember, Washington is prone to hyperbole, and the media is prone to overdramatize things. They're going to scare the bejeebers out of you because they want you scared, because then you're going to keep tuning in, finding out what's next, what are they going to do? Countdown to the ceiling, countdown to the fiscal cliff. So they want ratings, and they want you to keep tuned in, and the way they keep you tuned in is to scare you. So if you don't understand why you're investing the way you're investing, well, then you're going to fall prey to the hyperbole and the overdramatization that we see so constantly coming from the media.
So, Jim, let's talk about knowing what you want.
You know, this really struck me, and it was too bad we didn't get this in the last week, but I think this will be a good example. Why we think it's important not only to know what you want. My son Adam passed me an article. This took place, folks, last Friday. Now, many of you know that Twitter is announcing that they're going to be going public. They're going to have an IPO. Now, once their IPO was announced, investors rushed to participate, and they didn't do their homework first. So they gobbled up shares last Friday of a defunct electronics retailer called Tweeter Home Electronics. Their symbol was TWTR, which is just like Twitter's, but with one exception. There was a Q afterwards. So it was TWTRQ instead of Twitter's symbol, which is TWTR. They pushed Tweeter shares value up by 1,800%. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority had to actually step in and actually shut down trading of Tweeter and change its stock symbol to THEGQ. As of the day we were recording, Tweeter is still trading around a penny. Now, this mix-up made up for some great headlines like Tweeter tweaks ticker after Tweeter twaddle. Well, try to say that all in one word. So here was a good example of people rushing. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to get in on Tweeter IPO. And there they were. They bid up the stock of a bankrupt company 1,800% in a single story. So the lesson from this story is make sure you know what you want to get what you want to get. And that means really knowing what it is you're investing in and the purpose of each investment.
When we first meet with investors, Jim, I think one of the very first things we do is get to know who they are as an investor. And I think when you're investing for yourself, this is something you really have to make sure that you spend a little bit of time doing, which is getting to know yourself as an investor. How do you handle risk? What's your tolerance for loss? How much are you worth? In other words, how many assets do you have, whether they're real estate or maybe it's investment portfolios or whatever it is, or share in a business? What are you worth? What's your investment experience? What investments are you comfortable with? What are your goals for your investments? You really have to know these things about yourself first before you can figure out what blend of investments is going to make sense for you, which is what in our industry we call being suitable for you. So you have to know who you are as an investor before you start investing.
And I think a good example of this is investing in bonds. Individual bonds are a great investment for stability, predictability, and income in any portfolio. Now, if you're investing in bonds, the one thing they're not designed to do is for growth. So you can't look at the stock market and say, wow, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 14% this year, but my bonds aren't up. Well, bonds are not designed for growth. So when someone comes to me and talks about the return on their bond or the performance of their bond, I know that they don't understand what a bond is and what it's for. Yes, the market value of your bond is going to go all over the place, up and down, probably fluctuates less, especially if you buy individual bonds than stocks. But if you keep focusing on the current market value, you could drive yourself a little crazy fretting about how much it gained or lost for the day. But the reality is, if you hold your bond to maturity, you're going to get the face value of the bond. Your income is not going to change. You're going to get that income every 6 months when the bond pays its income. That will never change throughout the life of the bond. And if you plan on holding your bonds to maturity, you already know what the bond is going to be worth. You're going to get the face value. If you bought a $10,000, $100,000 bond, you know you're going to get that $100,000 back when it matures. And throughout the life of the bond, you're going to get that income. It's going to be as predictable as a Social Security check or a pension check, assuming that the bonds that you bought were high-quality bonds.
I think the only people who should really worry about the market value of their bonds day to day are people who do this bond trading for a living. I'm thinking about hedge fund managers who do arbitrage using bond portfolios and who are in and out of their bond portfolios constantly. You know, for your average investor holding a portfolio of bonds, you know, maybe you pay attention to the credit rating of the individual bonds, but its market value is kind of meaningless to you, especially if you're going to be holding it to maturity.
Yeah, I would say the most important thing if you're owning individual bonds, Kathleen, is that you focus on the credit rating, because that's the most important thing. Because remember, you're going to receive the income, and so credit risk is a big problem, because if a company's credit falters or worse is downgraded, that will not only affect the price, but then the income you receive and also the principal at maturity is at risk. So the most important thing is really not market value in the short term. It's really credit risk or credit rating. And I want to move forward to stocks, because a lot of investors have been on the sidelines in a great bull market that's been occurring since, let's say, March of 2009. And, you know, investors have missed out on almost 160% gain in the market. So when it comes to stocks, I mean, there's all kinds of stocks. There's small stocks, there's big companies, mega cap companies like an Apple or an Exxon. There's stocks that pay dividends, stocks that don't, stocks that are U.S.-based, stocks that aren't, stocks that are multinational, some that are focused in one country. Your goal with any stock usually is going to involve some component of growth. Conservative, moderate, aggressive is going to determine which one of those categories that you're in. Now, most people, when they get retired, they're going to be a little bit more on the conservative side. They're going to have a greater need for income. And that's why the large S&P 500 companies, the big Dow stocks that are paying a dividend, are a very important component, because they not only pay dividends, but over time those dividends grow. And when that happens, you know, you're going to get growth of principal. So you're going to take a little bit more risk, but you need to allocate some portion of your portfolio to meet those goals of want to haves, wish to haves, or taking care of inflation. Where are they going to come from? You know, your Social Security isn't going to keep you even with inflation. Your annuity isn't going to keep you even with inflation, nor is your bond. Those are designed to give you predictable income. The things, the want-to-haves, the wish-haves, they only come from one source. They come from growth-oriented investments. It could be investment real estate, or it can be the stock market. But you need to have that, or at least a portion of that component, factored into your portfolio. Otherwise, you're going to have no growth. You can forget about having the wish-haves or want-to-haves, because they're not going to be there, because where are you going to get the growth from?
I think it's a really important thing to think about, Jim, because I think that there's such a fear of loss with the stock market right now that people are sort of forgetting that there's also possibility for gain. And you shouldn't overweight one or the other of those. There's always risk of loss happening, but there's always opportunity for gain as well. And I feel like a lot of people have been really focusing on the one half of that equation and not the other for the last 4 or 5 years. I was going to talk a little bit about annuities, Jim, just because it's something that we mentioned as far as the Bill and Jan Smith plan we put together. As far as the purpose of annuities, they really have certain uses. You can use an annuity to sort of semi-protect your principal or semi-protect the growth of your principal or produce pretty reliable income. But annuities do have downsides as well. Just like other investments, they have risk. They involve fairly lengthy contract periods. There can be some pretty hefty withdrawal penalties. And some of the investment opportunities within the annuities, especially variables, can be fairly limited. And they often come with some form of administration fee. So an annuity can be an appropriate vehicle for certain things. But again, you need to make sure you understand the purpose of a specific type of annuity within your overall portfolio, and not just assume putting all your money in an annuity is the best way to handle your assets.
So first, you need to know what it is you want. Then you construct a portfolio with a blend of assets that meets each one of those needs that we talked about. What you need, what you want, and what you wish for. Then you tweak it and adjust it, and periodically, you revisit it. That way, you don't panic.
You know, Jim, speaking of panicking, I think a lot of business owners did that when California's tax changes were announced in 2011 and 2012. I know they're continuing to panic here in 2013 with an exodus of business out of California.
And that's why a lot of California companies are leaving for Texas, North Carolina, the Sun Belt. So we're going to be talking about the best states for business and related to that, some of the best states to actually retire in. Coming up next on the program is CNBC's senior correspondent, Scott Cohen. That's coming up right after this. Joining me on the program today is Scott Cohen. He's senior correspondent and lead investigative reporter at CNBC. And Scott, you publish a report, The Top States for Business. And this year, South Dakota came in at the top. I wonder if you might go through for our listeners some of the metrics that you use in terms of categorizing and what makes up a good state to do business. Could you touch on that, please?
Sure. We rank the states in 10 different categories, and each category has metrics within it. And we give those categories weight based on how frequently the states use those as selling points in all of their economic development marketing. So the category that carries the most weight typically, and it's the case again this year, is cost of doing business. Every state, it seems, is pitching that in one way or the other, that they're the low-cost state for business. And no state does as well in that in terms of objective metrics about cost than South Dakota, which has very low business costs pretty much across the board, whether you're looking at taxes, whether you're looking at utility costs, wage costs for business. They pretty much blow everyone away. And by winning that category, that really helped them to take the top spot overall.
Yeah, I was noticing not only do they have no individual or corporate income taxes, but I mean, low sales taxes, low property taxes, because I know, for example, in Texas, they don't have corporate or income taxes, but the property taxes could be high. But in South Dakota, it's not just taxes. They have the lowest utility rates, wages, and commercial rent. So all of that together, I guess, is what makes them one of the top states.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a misnomer when you think of Texas, because people do look at Texas as a low-cost state, and there they're looking at the tax structure, and indeed Texas has no individual or corporate income tax. But when you look at the overall cost of doing business, and it includes wages, because they have generated so many jobs in Texas, and you look at utility costs and rents, Texas is 35th in the cost of doing business category. So it's among the more expensive states to do business, in fact, at least in the bottom half of that, in the bottom tier. So we do try and look at everything that relates to cost, not just taxes.
You know, that really surprised me when I was looking at Texas, because when you think of Texas in terms of utility cost and things like that, you think, wow, this is a state that produces a lot of energy. You would think the cost would be lower.
You would think so, and in some cases it is, but when you look at things like industrial power costs, for example, electricity costs, and Texas is very expensive as far as that goes, as well as commercial power. They do well in the energy that they produce, like natural gas, but when you look at overall cost figures, they are among the lowest cost when it comes to tax burden, but they're sort of an also-ran in the other areas.
You know, something I found rather surprising, and you made a comment on it, North Dakota, which is a big shale play where oil, they're actually producing more oil than Alaska right now. Their success in this area also has contributed to some of their problems. They have the lowest unemployment rate, but they actually have a shortage of workers.
Right. And we look at, among our 10 categories, our economy, in which a low unemployment rate is a positive, but also workforce, in which a low unemployment rate means there's a shortage of workers, and it means that there is a shortage of available workers. So that does hurt them to some degree. You know, North Dakota has a lot of good problems to have, that being one of them, that, you know, a lot of people are going there. There's, as you said, a great energy story in North Dakota, but there's also growing pains because they've grown so fast, and that hurts when you're trying to build an economy.
You know, something that you pointed out in your study in 2013 was the first year where there was a broken pattern in which neither Texas nor Virginia came out on top because of the increasing focus on cost. Can you elaborate on that? Is it mainly infrastructure? Is it utilities? What's going on there?
Well, both of those states are relatively high wage states. So if we're going to put more emphasis, as the states do, on low cost of doing business, that's going to hurt them. The other issue that Virginia faced, and you know, Virginia has, as you said, it's always up until this year been first or second in our study, or at least near the top, and actually took the top spot in 2007, 2009, and 2011. Virginia also is very dependent on the federal government. That hurt them in terms of their credit rating. When the U.S. was downgraded, Virginia's credit rating got slapped with a negative outlook, and so that hurts them in our economy category. So Virginia has a lot of issues. They've also had issues with their infrastructure. They're trying to address that, and some of that's starting to seep into their rankings and some of our different metrics. But Virginia is not as strong a state for business as it once was, although it's still a powerhouse, finishing tied for fifth this year.
You know, when you talk about the cost of doing business, and of course factored into that is taxes, in the 2010 election, there was a major sweep in a lot of these states where they got governors that came in and said, look, if we want to improve our economy, we're going to have to make it more business friendly. Is that a long-term trend? Because analyst Meredith Whitney has written a book called The Fate of the States, and she's talking about the central corridor of the United States where many of these states that you're talking about in your survey fit right in.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Her book came out around the time that our rankings came out, and we didn't work with her on the rankings, but our rankings do bear out her theory that there is a great deal of growth. I think she refers to it as an emerging market in the Central Corridor. Some of it has to do with the low cost. In fact, a lot of it has to do with the low cost. It also has to do with the energy plays, not only in North Dakota, but also in places like Nebraska, Texas, Oklahoma, things like that, where you're looking at shale plays and things like that. But she is also looking at the cost, and as we keep saying, cost is a very important factor.
In your survey, and just for our listeners, the top five states, you've got South Dakota number one, Texas two, North Dakota three, Nebraska four, and Utah. Let's talk about the biggest pop and the biggest drop, because some states moved up and a few states moved down, including my own state of California.
Yeah, California is an interesting story every year when we do our top state study. I mean, California, as you know, came in 47th overall this year, but it is always at or near the top when it comes to technology and innovation, where it came in number two this year, usually is at or near the top, and access to capital, because so much venture capital still disproportionately goes to California. It's where anybody that's in high tech needs to at least have a finger in California, if not a full-blown presence there. But California is a very expensive state to do business in and is often criticized for its regulatory climate and its legal climate. And that hurts when you look at the 10 categories across the board.
You know, it amazes me because you do have a high concentration of technology companies that are in California, especially in Silicon Valley. But, you know, Scott, one of the things that you see is many of these companies, whether it's Apple, whether it's eBay, Oracle, some of the high technology names that we always talk about when we think of technology, they're building their plants in places like Austin, Texas, which, you know, eventually could start competing with Silicon Valley.
Well, it does on some levels, and that's the issue. Now, California will tell you that they are having some success in bringing back manufacturing business there. The economy in the state has improved a great deal. So they will tell you that if you judge them on the reasons that businesses feel they need to be there, whether it's a highly educated workforce, whether it's that critical mass of technology or whatever, or just the California lifestyle that nobody can compare. But we look across the board at all the different factors, and particularly the factors that the states are selling. And the chief among them, again, is low cost. And California is an expensive state.
You know, one thing I think Silicon Valley, I was watching a documentary on Steve Jobs, and not only did he have access to all these technology companies, but also what role does university and education play? Because you have Berkeley up there. You also have Stanford, where you have a lot of research in technology that is taking place with research. How much does that play?
Well, we look at education on a number of different levels. First of all, education is one of our 10 categories, but that looks not only at universities, it also looks at K-12 and school spending and things like that. So we take a broad look at education. We also look at technology and innovation, which reflects the research capabilities in the state, the patents in the state, and some of the effects of having a strong university system. And we also look at workforce. There's a component there where we look at the educational attainment of workforce. And so California, it does play a role, and it does play a role in California's rankings. And California, in terms of the workforce, is in the bottom tier, but it has to do with not just educational attainment, but also things like union membership, things like that. So you have to pick these apart just a little
Scott, let me extend your study out a little further, because I know that in our state we're seeing a lot of retirees move out because of the cost of living. Is your survey also applicable to, let's say, places to retire?
Well, it really depends on what you're looking for. And, you know, if you go to topstates.cnbc.com and you look through the different categories, you may want to look at quality of life. We rank all 50 states on that. That's one of our categories. We look at education. If you want to be near an area with strong schools, whether it be for continuing education, whether it be for property values, you can compare the states that way. And, you know, it really depends on what you're looking for. A solid business climate generally means a solid economy. And if you want to be someplace where you're in a stable economy, then this might help guide you a little bit.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, Nevada is very popular with retirees, Vegas, no taxes, lower cost of living. But when you're looking at a place to retire, the other things that you talk about, access to education, access to good quality health care, nice restaurants, services, and places like that, golf courses or whatever you like to do, those are the kind of things that businesses also like.
Right, they do. And keeping with our whole thesis that we rank the states on the categories that they use to sell themselves, a lot of states point out their quality of life and make that a selling point. Now, it's not necessarily the top-ranked category, but it's there. It's something that we look at. But there are contrasts. For example, Hawaii comes in first for quality of life. It comes in near the bottom for everything else and winds up 50th state in terms of doing business, but certainly is a nice place to be and probably not a bad place to retire if you can swing it.
As you've been looking at these surveys and publishing them each year, like one of the trends that we're following is Meredith Whitney's Central Corridor thesis as the new emerging market of the world. And we're seeing a lot more of that happen with, you know, plays on resources, companies relocating factories there, which is creating jobs. Is there a trend that you see emerging having done these surveys?
Well, again, I think that the attention to cost is important, and it's something to look at as economies are stressed and as businesses are looking for places to go. But there's a flip side to it. You know, South Dakota does well with cost of doing business and comes out on top of our study overall this year, but it pays some of the lowest wages around. So if you are a worker looking for a place to work, they have a worker shortage not that far off from their neighbor to the north in North Dakota, so there's a lot of work there, but it's not going to pay very well. And some of the feedback that we got after we released these rankings in July were from people in or around South Dakota saying, yeah, it's a great state for a company, but you might have to work two jobs in order to get by here. And so that's something to look at.
Well, listen, Scott, I know you've got a busy schedule. If our listeners would like to find out or do a little research on these states, either interest for relocating a business, trying to find a job, or maybe a place to live, how could they do so?
Well, they can go to CNBC.com, and if they want to look at our top state study in particular, it's topstates.cnbc.com. Also on the site, we have some slideshows on best states for retirement in terms of tax-friendly states for retirement, which I know is very important. You can search for that at CNBC.com. And this top state ranking is there. Again, topstates.cnbc.com. We do it every year. The next one's come out in July, and we're going to start crunching numbers fairly soon here. So stay tuned.
Well, Scott, thanks for joining us on the program. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that concludes my interview with Scott Cohen. A couple things that I'd urge you to do, because many of you are thinking of retirement. You're thinking of, okay, where am I going to live? Maybe, you know, the kids have grown up. They've moved out. You're thinking of relocating. Maybe you want to be closer to your kids. Your kids have moved someplace else. I advise you to go to that site. Take a look at not only the cost of doing business, the quality of life, but as Scott just mentioned, they also did best places to retire. And in the categories that they ranked some of the businesses, they took a look at not only the cost of living, the economy, but, you know, some things that are real important to you if you're thinking of retirement. Infrastructure. Do they have roads, highways, healthcare facilities? And this really gets into some of the things that get into quality life, access to continuing education, universities, restaurants, services, golf courses, things for recreation. So this will give you an idea to do a little homework if you've been thinking in the back of your mind, maybe we're living in a state that we don't want to stay. I know a lot of times you see people on the East Coast, they maybe grow up or work in New York, Massachusetts, they end up going down to Florida where it's cheaper to live and there's no taxes. So do take advantage of this tool that's available at CNBC, Top States for Business. And then you can take a look at top states for retirement. So on behalf of myself, Jim Poplava, and Kathleen Harris, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.